so this is Managing Chaos in Production, Testing versus Monitoring. I will say this is not a talk about engineering chaos in production. I find I don't have to engineer it. It just comes to me naturally. So this is a little bit more about dealing with that as a natural course of events. I had some alternative titles for this talk. This is the sort of one that gets you over the finish line. I was potentially going to call it this, which is monitoring. It's like testing, but it's in production, so it's actually important. I've been told that that might be a little standoffish to any like QA people who are out in the room. I don't mean to be standoffish. Again, it's just a thing that sometimes happens naturally. Some of you may have to do like a report to your boss about talks that you've seen and things that you've learned. If you are one of those people, feel free to use this as a description for the talk, right? This sounds really good. A discussion on trade-offs between testing and monitoring and how to apply them to a DevOps lifecycle. That should get you out of any trouble with your boss if you need to fill out a report like that. All right, so who am I? What do I do? All that kind of stuff. So I've been doing tech for many, many years now. I've done the devs, I've done the ops, I've done DBA work and a lot of other stuff in between. As of today, I am still the CEO at OmniTI, and what we do there is we basically build and operate large-scale systems. What is large-scale? A typical client probably has somewhere between 100,000 to 100 million users, and we believe pretty strongly that you can run that kind of infrastructure and have decent feature velocity with somewhere between like 8 to 10 people running the show. So that's sort of the approach that we take when we build and engineer stuff. And so a lot of the lessons that we've learned have come from very tight constraints on the sort of people side of things, but still having to deal with sort of large-scale issues that come up. So, all right. Another note, in case you're wondering, slides will be available. You can hit me up. I'm at RobTreat2 on the Twitter. So you can either ask for them there or I'll post a link there once they're up. If you love what you're seeing and think it's awesome, feel free to tweet me there. That's great. If you have any like strong disagreements and would like to write me a nice treatise on like why everything I've said is wrong, my email address is robert@omniti.com. I will totally read that and take care of it in the most appropriate way. I've been known to blog very rarely at axilla.net. And like I said, I'll post the slides on slideshare.net/axilla. So you don't have to go crazy taking notes or pictures. You'll be able to see the stuff afterwards. So, and the video should be online at some point as well, barring the FCC doesn't shut me down. So, all right, let's talk about testing. How many people here have heard of testing? Okay, I'm a little worried about some of you. I guess not everybody made it to the coffee this morning. That's okay. So if you think about testing and think about some things related to testing, and you had to sum it up in one word, what is testing and what do you really feel about it, I'm pretty sure everybody would agree that testing is required, right? You really can't do software development without having some form of testing, right? And there's a lot of debate on what is appropriate testing and you know, what is the right kind of testing and different ways you can do testing and all that jazz. But beyond the thought that testing is a required aspect of doing, you know, software development and IT in this world that we live in, the other thing that I think is really important is for people to understand that testing is not enough. And I see this in a lot of shops where I tend to think it's sort of an older school mentality of this idea that, like, we're going to test our way out of having problems in production, right? And that is sort of a false statement on its surface, right? It's not enough. And it doesn't really matter the kind of testing you do. How many people here do one of these kinds of testing on some of the stuff that they run, right? Like, it's all of these, there are different formats. And it does kind of depend on what is the nature of the thing that you're building, right? Whether you want to do unit testing or functional or what have you, right? And these are all sort of valid methods in their own way. But I think the problem is it doesn't really matter, like, which forms of testing that you pick, right? Even if you pick them all, which some places, how many people actually do all of these, or your shop does all of these? So there's a few, right, where they actually are doing all of this stuff. So there's a heavy testing component there. The issue that I have with that, though, is I find that testing tends to give people, and not necessarily the technical folks who are in operations, but I think people within a company in general, gives them a false sense of security, right? Because they run all these tests and because they do all this testing work, there is an assumption that they won't have problems escaping out into production. But I find, like, if you go start to look at most testing and how people are doing it, the first issue that you kind of run into is that testing tends to be pretty deterministic, right? And it makes sense. Oh, my Lord, we lost something. Hold on. See, you can never. You can't do enough testing. Production problems will happen. Hey, it's back. Okay. Be very careful. All right, so testing is deterministic. And that makes sense because you need to be able to have testing be repeatable, right? That's a big part of why you do testing. And so if testing is got to be repeatable, you're going to use a lot of the same use cases over and over again. That does mean that you're going to have gaps that start to arise. And the first place that I usually see this as a problem, especially as you start to scale, is you start to have issues with data, right? And data, it's good times. Thinking about different ways data can bite you, right? The first ones sort of get sort of obvious as you start to scale. They just become issues that you can't get past, right? It's quantity of data, the amount of data you're collecting, and how quickly it's building up, right? And then the quality of that data. You know, when you first start a service and you're putting it out there, if the database, you know, or the data that is required is a few gigs of data, probably everybody could store that on their laptop. But as you approach that sort of like terabyte level scale, you know, or if you get into petabytes, like it's not easy to give everybody a copy of that data. Let alone if you have, you know, security requirements or compliance issues where you've got to like obfuscate data, it takes time to do that. You can try to do sampling, but if you have any kind of like, you know, integrity issues or relationships in the data, trying to do random sampling of that and pulling all the related data becomes very cumbersome. So all of those problems around data start to become issues to allow to have good testing environments, right? And so that's the first thing that we see. But then there are other sort of issues around this. How many of you have heard of the Wolf plus 585 issue? So, okay, so not a huge number of QA people in the room, which is probably good. I won't get ambushed afterwards. So Wolf 585, if you do a lot of QA stuff, you'd probably have heard of this. And I think that this is still the longest world. You can look this up on Wikipedia, but the longest name in the world, right, is this dude from Germany, because Germans like to make really long words for everything, apparently. But Hubert Blaine Wolf, right. So he's credited, senior, I probably shouldn't leave that part out. He's credited with having the world's longest last name at the moment, right? So imagine you're building a new service, whatever it is, and this dude shows up at your site, right? And he goes to fill in his like first name, last name, right? And I don't even want to know about his email address. So how many of you think that like he would actually be able to make it through your system and actually sign up for a service? Right, I think for most people, he's probably going to break something somewhere because most people are not going to really think that you need to be able to support names that are this long. And I guess in fairness, you don't have to because he's got the longest one, right? So you're really only going to annoy like this one guy if you can't support this long of a name, right? But a lot of people I see, you know, they have cutoffs that are what we think is arbitrarily long, like, you know, who has more than 100 digits in their last name? Probably not many people, but they are out there, right? Not to mention you can start to get into issues with like UTF-8 and, you know, different languages. Certainly we see that as a jump when you go from like a US-based service into the international realm, right? You start to get a flood of more of these names that have different character sets and that kind of thing. And it brings us back to sort of the central problem that, like, again, with data, users are always out there. They're always looking for ways, unintentionally, of course, of breaking your system. But you can't really understand how users are going to affect this system in like a predetermined way, right? Because you don't know who your users are necessarily going to be. You can have an idea of like the type of user, right? And maybe if you know in certain countries you're going to get, you know, certain names and this kind of thing that you have to deal with. But it's hard to really understand that ahead of time and be able to outthink them. How many of you are familiar with the corrupted blood incident? Okay, so we got a couple out in the crowd. So this is going to be super high level, so you two guys don't get mad at me when I give the overview. But I think this will also give another sort of example of how this stuff can really bite you. So if you guys are familiar with, you know, sort of online role-playing type games, right, World of Warcraft, that type of thing. A number of years ago, I think it's probably about a decade ago now at this point, there's one of these games, and they invented this game mechanic that they called Corrupted Blood. And the basic mechanic was, it was kind of like a virus. So if you got this, right, you would start losing health and energy within the game. And eventually, if you did nothing, you would just die from it, right? And the best way to get rid of it was to basically like try to tag somebody else and give it to them. Or if you died and you were standing near other players, they would get it from you, right? So it was sort of an interesting game mechanic. And I think the original idea was, you know, we're going to hide this out in the woods someplace, so to speak, right, the proverbial digital woods, where not too many people should find it. If you do find it, you're a high enough level character that this will give you an interesting challenge to try to deal with, you know, but probably won't kill you. Maybe it will, but you should have the skills maybe and the wherewithal to be able to fight it off. And that worked, you know, initially, because those are the people that stumbled across it. But eventually somebody who was high enough level stumbled across it and got this. And they also had an ability which was like teleport. And they used it to basically teleport back into one of the cities. And this next graphic I'm about to show you is graphic. So once they teleported back in the cities, basically that meant anybody standing around them, they could tag and they would get this thing. And because in the cities is where new characters spawn and very low-level characters are running around, they would pretty much die instantly, right? And as soon as they died, everybody around them would get it, right? And so you can just sort of see this, like, you know, plague-type situation that started spreading through the city, basically just killing off people, you know, one over the other. And it actually, like, you would spawn a new character, and it'd be too late for you already because you'd spawn in the city, and then you'd immediately get this problem, and your character would die off, right? So they basically started wiping out entire cities because of this game mechanic that they had introduced. And they actually had to, like, stop the game to, like, patch the system to take this out of the game in order to have people be able to play again, right? Not something that they had actually conceived it would happen. And it's interesting because you sort of figure, like, well, game players often, we see this in games a lot, like, they play the games, the people who make it play the games, they still don't see all those combinations that are going to happen, right? And this is where testing, again, it falls into these traps. Trying to have enough foresight to see all the things that are going to happen, it's just never going to be there, right? There are too many use cases for you to even try to think about in most systems that we have, right? At this point, I think most of us, if you look at sort of, you know, sort of good hygiene for postmortems or, you know, incident reviews or whatever you want to call them, if you look at good hygiene for that, you know, one of the first things to say is like, hey, we understand there is no like single root cause to an issue, right? These are complex systems that have many combinations that bring problems together. And so thinking about the fact that there are these number of combinations out there, how are you as an engineer or an architect supposed to sort of guess how it's going to break given all the different factors that you can have, right? And the other part, of course, is that there can be changes to the assumptions that you have, right? You don't necessarily know what's going on, especially when you start factoring in like third-party services and that type of thing. So changes to assumptions in prod, maybe even to the business, right? The number of use cases, your inability to predict the future, otherwise you'd have won the Powerball last week, right? Like those reasons basically, like it's a losing game to think you're going to be able to add enough tests, right? And time again, you'll see, you know, usually there's a management sort of driven problem where there's a bug in production and they're sort of like, why aren't we testing for that? It would seem like we should have tested for that. And so you really have to think about like, well, what is the goal of testing then? If I'm saying that like there's no way you can test yourself out of breaking stuff, right, then what is actually the goal of what we're going to do with testing? And I think what we've sort of come to the conclusion, the first thing you have to sort of say to everybody is that our goal here is not testing for testing's sake, right? We're not really trying to get 100% code coverage for the testing that we're going to do, right? The goal of testing, when you're thinking about how do I get software, you know, written and then into production and used by the users, the real goal of it is just to win a confidence game, right? And you sort of say, like, confidence, what do you mean by that? So I think this statement, you know, we want to be reasonably confident that the code we're going to put into production will not break production, right? And it doesn't take 100% code coverage to actually have a reasonable level of confidence, right? And I want to emphasize reasonably confident. Again, you can't know, you can't be 100% certain that you will never break production. You're trying to figure out what is the appropriate subset of what I need to look at, right? So that I can actually still develop quickly, get features out, but also have a pretty, you know, pretty safe thought that this is not going to blow everything up. And you won't always be 100% correct on that, right? But you can have reasonable confidence with that if you pare it down. Again, testing is very good for known knowns. And if you have the resources to build out a lot of QA and you want to shoot for that 100% code coverage, if you want to do that in sort of an offline process, I don't even have a real problem with that, right? Like, do a nightly build that does like some kind of like deep regression testing on the system to see if you can find errors. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but you've got to understand there's a trade-off, right? If it takes you an hour to run the test before you can push into production, people are not going to be able to push features out, you know, with any kind of quickness. And that goes for hot fixes and security patches and any of that kind of stuff, right? The more that you have in the way of that pipeline, just the harder it's going to be for people to do that. So if we look at testing being good for the known knowns, right, the things we can script, the use cases that we can predict, where it falls over, like I've said, is the unknown unknowns, right? It is those things out in production. It is the users. The users, if you just get rid of them, right? It is those users that are out there that are thinking of ways that you didn't think of to break your system. So how do you deal with that problem? Well, that's where monitoring comes into play, right? That's why I have testing versus monitoring. So this is not something I really think I should need to convince anybody here why monitor. Everybody here, I hope, believes in monitoring. I will say I use the word hope because, you know, we do a fair amount of consulting work as well, and you would be surprised the number of shops that we go into where they don't have monitoring, or, you know, maybe like the DBA is set up monitoring on the database, but nobody does any monitoring on the web servers, you know, or what have you, some version of that problem. Because they don't, whatever, they don't really get that monitoring is important. But hopefully everybody here, right, you're all on board with monitoring. If you're not, right, you need some reasons to be further convinced. Again, software is never perfect. I think from other talks you've seen here at the conference, you realize software is not going to be perfect. There are bugs just waiting out there to get us. The complexity of systems, again, it's just getting, you know, more complex every day. External dependencies is a thing that I see people gloss over quite a bit, and I'm a little bit surprised. You know, if you think about, there's been a reportage now from GitHub on the incident that they had last week, right? Think about the number of businesses that were actually down because they couldn't push to production, right? Or couldn't maybe even do any development because all their stuff was in GitHub, and now that's an external dependency on their software development pipeline, right? But it doesn't even have to be that. Like, we've had seen issues where, you know, Facebook logins suddenly don't work, right? And so half your users maybe can't get in because you thought, you know, it would make this really awesome service if you could log in with your Facebook ID, you know? But if it has an issue, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be down, right? You just need to have a latency issue that is long enough to cause problems, right? So those third-party and external dependencies that we kind of sort of think, you know, I would generally think GitHub is probably going to be more reliable than what I'm building, right? I think, you know, Facebook would probably be up as long as my stuff is up. They seem to have a lot of good, smart engineers. They need to hire more, I've heard. But, you know, like, they have their issues too. Like, everybody's going to have them, so you have to account for that, right? So the other thing, of course, is because things are always changing when it comes to production. Even if you think that it's a fairly static thing, right? You build your app, you put it out there, and you walk away for a couple of weeks and you come back, maybe you expect things to be the same. I do believe in magic fairies that magically change code, because I swear I've seen that before. But even without that, if you put that aside, things are always changing a lot in production, and by that I mean, again, so you have users coming to the site, the way they're using the site, the way they deal with features. You're doing everything over a network, so, you know, latency issues can come up. There's issues, just, you know, the internet itself is not a static thing. So all of those things that are changing in production mean you've got to have ways to see what's going on out there, right? And that's the monitoring component that we're talking about. People then ask, okay, so what are you going to monitor, right? What's the right approach to that? And there's a lot of different opinions out there. I've heard this one. This is a good one for the South, I suppose. In God we trust, but in all other things we monitor. I don't know that I would subscribe to this language exactly, but I do. I'm a pretty large proponent of doing monitoring. I would sort of say anything that you're running as part of your system probably needs some monitoring on that, but then I'll need to define monitoring a little bit tighter, because otherwise you could run into trouble, right? But just think about, you know, again, web servers, databases, right, your front-end load balancers, like all of those various pieces that are involved in you know, putting a service together. Integration points are hard to monitor in a lot of cases, but trying to do that as well. I think application monitoring certainly is a good thing to have, and I think a little bit underrated from the operational side. If you can monitor user behavior, that's also a difficult thing to monitor, it seems, or at least people don't do it much. But sort of like activity on certain features within your application, you know, are also nice things to have. Is that enough of things to monitor? Well, I think there's a couple of things missing off that list. We'll talk about that in a second. Some would say that might be too much, right? You can suffer from sort of monitoring overload and have so much information that how do you process it all, right? We've certainly seen cases where that is going on as well. So you really have to ask yourself, like, what is actually important when it comes to things that you're going to monitor? And in this case, I think using the word monitor as a little bit more of an exact, like, you know, things you're going to alert on and try to raise notifications about, right? That really needs to speak to what is actually important and what's going on with those services. Back in the day, because this would never happen now, I'm sure, there used to be this messaging service that occasionally would have these outages. And what was weird about sometimes the outages that you would see is that you would go and, you know, you could, like, curl the server or ping it or whatever, and it, like, everything would seem like it was up. Right. If you went to the site, you do an HTTP check, like you'd get a 200 back that, yes, things are working. But you would know that you sent a message that somebody should have received and they didn't actually receive it. Right. And so now you have the sort of issue is like, well, is the thing up and working or is it not up and working? Right. Is it a degraded service? And it brings back this idea that, like, hey, remember, just because the servers are working doesn't mean your business is actually functioning. Right, and whatever business that you're in, whatever the mission is of the organization that you're working with, right, you have to think about what are the goals of that organization and what does it mean for that organization to be working. Right, it's probably not just that the servers are all on. We had a customer once that put it this way, and this is really, I mean, it sounds kind of funny, but it's a pretty crystallizing way to think about it. He was kind of upset. We were spending time putting, like, temperature graphs together for, like, racks in a data center. And he, you know, just really didn't understand, like, why would you care about the temperature of the servers? And there are reasons to care about the temperature of servers, although I think we found out those reasons aren't as strong as we used to think that they were. But his basic thought was, like, you know, I don't care if the servers are on fire as long as I'm still making money. And if you think about that again, like, it sounds like a throwaway thing, but on the other hand, like, who's to say that maybe those servers can work when they're on fire, right? So if everything is still running, like, maybe I don't really care that they're on fire. Like, that's cool. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter. Or maybe it's only some servers are on fire and you have other ones that are, you know, you got failover and redundancy. So why do you care if they're on fire? Maybe you don't. I tend to think a lot of people use monitoring to focus on the wrong things, right? And it's usually because we have a very narrow view of our jobs, right? If you're, you know, if you're the one who's, like, put together a message broker within the system, like, you care about monitoring around this message broker and keeping it up, right? You're not so much concerned about the other things that are using and consuming your message broker. But that's a pretty narrow view, right, of thinking about the message broker and not thinking about it in a way that is, like, holistic about what is the purpose of the message broker within this greater system and the other people who are relying on it. I would partially say this is my fault. I do a fair number of conference talks. I have issued the phrase monitor all the things, like, in the past. And I assume people, you know, have their stickers and stuff for that. So probably people did it. I'm going to put more blame on monitoring vendors because that way I feel better about myself. Not any of the monitoring vendors that might be here, but, like, other ones that are out there, you know, that like to beef on Twitter about stuff. You know, they also, I think every one of them, like, the paradigm is, like, the more stuff you monitor, right, like, the more money they make. So that's an issue. And even in the open source projects, right, like, again, the more stuff you monitor, the sort of, the larger the footprint becomes for those services and the more important they become. So a lot of people would encourage you to monitor everything as much as you can. We got to be smarter about how we're talking about monitoring, right? Like, that's the thing that is really sort of the problem, because monitoring is such a generic term. And there are, again, people who have taken a lot of time to craft very long and wordy sort of statements on what monitoring is and what it isn't and all those sort of related keywords. I'm going to just chalk it up to, like, usually when we're talking about monitoring, we actually just mean visibility, right? We're talking about the ability to see things that are going on within our servers. And so we use that term sort of informally. And there is a time when you need to be much more technical about what you're talking about, but I think usually you can cut people a break when they're saying monitoring. Probably they just mean visibility into systems and services. I do believe in the general concept of trying to do metrics collection for, like, all the things, right? If you can collect that data, ideal in a system where you don't have to, like, understand how you're going to graph it all, but you can just, like, make sure you have the data to a certain point. That's definitely useful when you go back to debug and have to look at things. So do that metrics collection piece of it, right? But if you think of monitoring in your head as, you know, things that you're going to alert on and try to raise notifications about, monitor what's going to affect your business, right? Those are the things that you really want to have an understanding of. And you can think about that from a top-down approach, right? Thinking about your business, what are you doing? Understand your business, maybe define baselines that are important to you, like how many registrations would you always expect to be getting every hour, something like that. And then start to correlate that data back to actual systems metrics. I'll give you an example here of one that we had. Online marketing company, they had a large e-commerce component into their site as well. So they had about 100 million users at the time, and they sent about 1 billion emails a month. So it was a fair amount of email. The code base across the different services that we ran, about 300,000 lines of code, so not an insignificant code base. And then at the time, we were collecting about 5,600 metrics on the system as a whole, right? So it's not like we have a dashboard display with all the metrics and graphs, right? That's not going to happen when you have that much sort of metrics collection going on. Anyway, so one day we get a call, because all stories unfortunately seem to start with a call from your customer. And they're like, hey, we were looking at some of the graphs. And the way that we tend to do this, so we are actually monitoring, right? We're doing metrics collection on business impacting things, right? So we graph revenue through the system. And it's part of the same graph system that all the all the computers are on, right? So we can correlate that information. And we expose all of that to the client so they can see if they want to see the CPUs, they can see the CPUs. If they want to see the revenue, they can see the revenue. Anyway, so they're looking at revenue and they look at it and they're like, you know, there's a dip in our revenue, right? Like the last couple of days. Seems lower than usual. And like, we're curious, what did you guys do that caused us to lose revenue, right? And so we're like, oh, well, right, I'm sure we did something. So we overlaid traffic across that graph of revenue to see like, well, what does traffic look like? And when you looked at the traffic, it was like, oh, there's a similar dip in traffic. So your problem is that you aren't getting as much traffic to the website, and that's really actually probably an issue. Go talk to your sales and marketing people to see why their campaigns aren't working, because that's almost certainly where the problem is in my head. That's what I said. But to the client, I was like, huh, I see a dip in traffic. Let me see if there's any issues going on with the servers. I want to make sure there were no problems during this dip. And so, you know, we had a graph on load time, so we put load up there, and it was like, no, load looks pretty even. Like, that's all cool. Doesn't seem to correlate to anything. At some point, you know, you call in the like application developers, like, hey, you guys doing any pushes or anything? And of course, one app dev is always going to be like, I'm sure it's the database. Like, look at the database. So we overlay database graphs, like, yeah, there's no activity. Like, it's, you know, it's totally chill. The database is happy. This is not a database problem. It is neither lupus or a database problem. Just remember those two things. And so we keep sort of looking and doing these overlay exercises where we're trying to find metrics that have changed or look different. We did eventually find the culprit, which was email bounces, right? And so what was going on was bounce activity had risen for the emails that they were sending out. Because of that, fewer people were seeing those emails in their inboxes. They weren't clicking on those emails to go to the site to actually buy stuff, right? So that led to the revenue decline. And I thought of this like, you know, so what if we didn't monitor email, right? Like, what if we couldn't overlay that as a graph? Like, that would be kind of a difficult problem to deduce. So that was really, you know, we were kind of lucky we had the graph in place, but we also had the metrics collected on that. If it wasn't monitored, obviously it would be after that incident. And I think the thing to remember here is, like, instrumentation is never done. There are always aspects of the system that you have to deal with, right? A few weeks later, we had the same symptoms. Metrics all looked normal, but we were seeing higher decline rates on credit cards. And so we called them up because we were like, hey, we're going to be proactive this time. Like, we're seeing higher decline rates on your stuff. I think there's an issue going on. And the business side is like, oh, yeah, Amex has blocked us. We have a dispute. Like, it should be resolved by Tuesday, so don't worry about it. You know, and we're like, I guess we haven't fully DevOps the whole organization yet. But, you know, so, all right, well, we'll check back on Tuesday and see what's going on. All right, so TLDR, right? It is testing and monitoring, not testing or monitoring. Don't get in a fight about those things. You got to have both of them, right? You got to think about the way you're going to do your testing and how it's going to have its impact on being able to do, you know, good feature velocity, getting stuff out into production. I can't stress this enough. Understand the business. Figure out how to correlate the things that you're doing to how the business works, because that is the best way to get the business side on your side, right? If you still think that you guys are on different sides. Again, increase observability within your systems, whether that's metrics or tracing or whatever. You're always trying to find better ways to see what is going on. There's always going to be problems that are hidden from you. Monitor things that are impactful, right? Look for those things that will cause issues to the business, right? If it's declining revenue, declining signups, that kind of thing. And then I always have to say, only alert on actionable emergencies. If you can't actually fix it, don't wake anybody up for it. And I think the man wants me to be out of time, so thank you very much.